Like most other intercontinental locations, Russia was still a big unknown, except to the Russians, and they weren't providing information. What little scraps of intel had leaked out since the megacull close to 200 years before had to be assembled like a jigsaw puzzle, with most of the pieces missing. It was a certainty that Moscow had been hit very hard, as had most of the other industrial cities. The entire country had suffered the nuclear winter like the rest of the nuke-ravaged planet, but because of its extreme northern latitudes, it was believed that for over 30 years, temperatures rarely rose above 5 degrees Fahrenheit. Speculation had it that more Russians died during the Big Chill than during the actual Holocaust. Other than that, the conditions in Russia could only be inferred from very old reports. Supposedly, a form of the old Stalinist industrialization regime had been revived, at least in the century following the nuke cost, but even that intel was too fragmented to be reliable. It was word of mouth, too little detail separated by too many years, though a militia unit called the Internal Security Network had been identified. As Kane and Grant were aware, rumors of a Russian base in Alaska had circulated for years, but were never found to have any solid basis beyond lingering paranoia. In the control center, the main monitor screen showed only a sweeping, vast snowscape, an infinity of windswept whiteness. Old craters, the rad levels still too high to allow snow to settle on them, pockmarked the ground. Though they resembled a pattern of dots, Kane realized that some of the larger craters might have been a quarter of a mile in diameter. The image dissolved, replaced by another view of the white wasteland. The terrain was scored by roadways and railroad tracks. In the distance, a tiny cluster of dark, stalk-shaped objects reared from the ground. A suggestion of spired minarets could be seen atop a few of them.
"These are the most recent and best satellite photos we have obtained of the Moscow vicinity. They were taken some 30 years ago, and obviously some rebuilding has been going on."
"How could you get pics of Mongolia and not of Russia?"
"That country's atmosphere is still too densely ionized for a satellite recon. At this point, the ionization blanket is probably a seasonal phenomenon, but we are unable to time the satellite's flyovers to coincide with the clear periods. We were lucky to get these views."
"But we don't have an idea of the current level of their society. We don't know what they have or what they don't have."
"We know one thing they have, at least. A Matrans gateway."
Lakesh pointed to a tiny light glowing on the sprawling Mercator map on the wall.
"That's the place. An outer suburb of Moscow called Perodolinko, about 20 miles from the city center."
"You're sure?"
"Do you recall me telling you that after the first Matran successes, we built the units in modular form so they could be shipped to and assembled in other locations?"
"Yes, but I assumed you meant the redoubts."
"That's where the majority of them went, yes. But a few went to other places. Perodolinko, for one."
"Why?"
"Glasnost, perestroika, a thawing in east-west relations, an overt sharing of material goods, a covert sharing of technology."
"If America and Russia got on so well, there shouldn't have been a war."
"No, there shouldn't have been. You know my thoughts on that."
Brigid, Kane, and Grant did know his thoughts, but they didn't pretend to understand them. According to what Lakesh had learned from Operation Kronos, not only was the Holocaust preventable, it was not supposed to have happened. Operation Kronos had disrupted the Kronon structure and triggered a probability wave dysfunction. Lakesh didn't believe that the past was a fixed object, immutable and unchanging.
"At any rate, the gateway unit is inside a dacha."
"A what?"
"A kind of country house."
"Exactly. It was a dacha given to the American diplomatic staff. That was the cover story, at least. In reality, it was to prove to the Russians that the totality concept technology worked."
"So they knew about it?"
"Of course. Many Russian electrophysicists and quantum theorists were involved in aspects of Over Project Whisper. Perodolinko itself had been a kind of artists' and writers' commune, at least for those adhering to the party line. Later, it became something of an enclave for scientists."
"How do you know if the gateway still works?"
"We still receive a positive read on the phase transition inducers. However, the target auto-sequence initiators show a negative."
"And that's bad."
"Not necessarily. It could just mean a sensor isn't transmitting a green signal as it should."
"What if the thing's inoperable? We could jump there, and if the receptor coils aren't powered up..."
"If we can't verify the jump at this end, we'll choose the abort option and transmit you to an alternate unit.
Alternate unit? Like where? Cobaltville?
Perhaps. Dulce, maybe. At least you'd know your way around.
Not funny, old man.
Don't worry, friend Kane. The worst-case scenario is that we'll hold your patterns in the digital security interlock until we can establish a transit line back here.
Grant glared at the door leading to the jump chamber.
I hate those fucking things.
It's better than walking. Now, I have to be back in Cobaltville early tomorrow, so I won't be here to see you off. Collect what ordnance you require from the armory, but I insist you do not wear your magistrate armor.
Why not?
According to Bridget, this man Sverdlovsk had knowledge of the baronies and of gateways, so it stands to reason that other Russian officials whom you may encounter will have such knowledge as well. There is no need to advertise your point of origin and former fraternity, even if you are no longer affiliated with it.
Assuming we're able to make the jump, what do you expect us to do over there?
I expect you to spy, friend Grant. I expect you to return with enough hard data regarding Russia's connection to the Tushegun that we can formulate a plan of action.
We don't speak Russian.
I speak Russian.
You're doing it again, old man.
Doing what, friend Kane?
Sending an academic out into a hell zone. What are you trying to do?
Lakesh turned and shuffled toward the door.
It's quite cold in Russia, even this early in the fall, so I will inform the jump prep crew to provide you with the proper dress. There will be a map prepared and ready for you, as well as the standard survival equipment. Unfortunately, the map is based on landmarks 2 centuries old. Best we could do. You will embark at 0800 tomorrow morning.
Lakesh exited the room.
Why do you keep baiting him, Kane? Why do you behave toward him like he's an enemy?
Why are you so sure he isn't?
He's not Baron Cobalt.
No, he's not. In many ways, he's Baron Cobalt's mentor.
What that comment suggests more than anything else is that you are disorganized mentally and emotionally. The only time you act like you're together is when you have a blaster in your fist.
She turned sharply on her heel and stalked out of the control center. Kane and Grant walked out to the corridor, heading for the armory.
Not good, Kane. She could be right.
She very well could be. So could I.
They entered the armory. It was a huge room, stacked nearly to the ceiling with wooden crates and boxes. The walls were lined with a half dozen tall, glass-fronted cases. M16A1 assault rifles were neatly stacked in one, and an open crate beside it was filled with hundreds of rounds of 5.56mm ammunition. There were SA-80 subguns, copperheads, and 9mm Heckler & Koch VP-70 semi-automatic pistols, complete with holsters and belts. Stacked neatly in a corner were bazookas, tripod-mounted M249 machine guns, and several crates of grenades. Every piece of hardware, from the smallest caliber hand blaster to the biggest bore M79 grenade launcher, was in pristine condition. They went through the crates and the cases, picking and choosing from their lethal contents. Both of them took 4 grens apiece, an implode, 2 incendiaries, and a Hi-X. They attached them to the combat harnesses they would wear beneath their coats. They clipped 3 20-round magazines for their sin-eaters to the harnesses as well. Grant didn't speak as he carefully inspected the ordnance. He had that grim, hooded look in his dark eyes Kane knew well.
Something on your mind?
Grant didn't answer for several uncomfortable moments.
I asked if something...
I heard you.
You're wondering the same thing I'm wondering.
And what the hell would that be?
It would be that we're running off to fight an old fart's private war. And it's not enough for me to know who we're fighting anymore. I need to know why we're fighting. Otherwise, we might as well be back in Cobaltville, burning down slaggers of the pits.
For a second, Grant scowled at him, his eyes distant. Unhappiness seemed to settle on his broad shoulders like a heavy cloak. After a few moments of silence, he moved visibly to shake it off. He returned his attention to his combat harness.
I know why. Death is always simple.
But not the ways of dealing with it, or even facing it.
You don't have to go on this op, you know. You don't have to go on any op. This isn't a mag's call to duty. You haven't sworn an oath here. You can bow out, stand down, find yourself a remote little spot, and live in a tent with a sticky slut for all I care. I don't give a shit anymore.
Yes, you do. You need me at your back. Old, tried, and true. Not an unreliable historian.
At this point, Kane, I'm starting to wonder just how reliable you really are. I'm gonna get some rest. If you're going with us, 0800 comes awfully early.
Grant turned and strode out of the armory and down the corridors. He looked past the electronically locked door to Balaam's cell, and he grimaced. Like Kane, he had never visited the Entity's confinement facility a second time. His initial reaction to the creature had been a primal, mindless urge to kill it. Lakesh had claimed at the time that his xenophobic response was quite natural and human, but Grant didn't have the inclination to go near the thing ever again. Grant knew immediately that he had been out of line with Kane. He had no right to pass judgment on him. Kane held himself solely responsible for their exile, and his self-anger sometimes surfaced as overprotectiveness toward Baptiste or as a tendency to provoke Lakesh. Undeniably, Kane was responsible, but Grant didn't blame him. He had served with and fought back-to-back with the man for many years, and he owed him his life several times over. True, the peeling away of Grant's mag identity and his mag purpose had been hard to endure, especially during those first weeks in Cerberus. Now, when he thought of his years as a magistrate, it brought only a brief, sad ache. He had never been one to plan for his future, and he had become well-conditioned to disappointments in his life, so he was stoic in the face of physical and emotional pain. Grant had followed Brigid Baptiste's lead and buried himself in the new work Cerberus offered. It was an exciting experience to rediscover his capacity for independent thinking and to contemplate and explore new concepts. Unlike Kane, he made a concerted effort to get to know the other Cerberus personnel, Bry, Farrell, DeFore, Banks, and the others. Most of them were brilliant and wayward members of different divisions in other vills, who had fallen afoul of barony laws in one fashion or another. Through Lakesh's machinations, they ended up in Cerberus instead of executed. But old mag habits died very hard. On occasion, he still thought of his fellow exiles as slaggers, as criminals, and of Lakesh as a dangerous subversive. He managed to push all of it to the back of his mind, storing it with his memories of Koboldville and all the other things that were past and he wasn't particularly anxious to think about. Grant's quarters at Cerberus weren't quite as spacious as his flat back in the enclaves of Koboldville, but they were a bit better appointed. The bed was much larger and very comfortable. Unfortunately, as he gazed at it, he found himself face to face, so to speak, with another subject he wasn't particularly anxious to think about. Domi reclined on the bed, on her belly, one hand cupping her chin. She was naked, except for bright red stockings that encased her long legs to her upper thighs. She grinned at him, a speculative, insolent play of her lips and a flashing of straight teeth. He couldn't help but notice that her eyelids and lips were painted the same cool shade of aquamarine. Those marvelous, strange red eyes held him, and they glinted like rubies on either side of her delicate, thin-bridged nose.
Waiting for you, again.
You're wasting your time, again.
Domi's pale blue lips pouted in disappointment, and she closed her big eyes.
You don't want me. You reject me. Boo-hoo. You lie. Big time you want me.
Domi slowly rolled over onto her back, her head hanging over the foot of the bed. Grant struggled to think clearly. He found his eyes shifting from her face to the small, hard-tipped breasts that resembled porcelain doorknobs, past them to her soft, slightly rounded belly, and then to the naked juncture of her curving thighs. Her eyes watched the journey his gaze took. It took him longer than he wanted to force his attention away from her nudity. He knew from past experience how difficult it was. Although Lakesh, and presumably other men in the redoubt, found Domi's flirtatious manner and revealing mode of dress entertaining, he was troubled by it, and he wasn't sure why. There had been other involvements with women during his life, some encountered through the line of duty, prospective Baron-approved mates, and others through passions discovered in the course of a mission. Domi could have qualified as one of the latter, but he saw her as a child. Because of her sexual servitude to the pit boss of Koboldville, the late Gwanna Teague, Grant viewed her as a victim. Both of them had taken a hand in Gwanna's bloody demise, though Domi gleefully accepted the lion's share of the responsibility. She had cut his throat. As far as Grant was concerned, sharing in the chilling of a human being, even one as deserving as old Guana, wasn't a sufficient foundation upon which to build a relationship. He was genuinely attracted to the girl, but he doubted she would be satisfied with an uncomplicated, strictly physical relationship for very long. And while he was fond of her, her emotions were too strong, too simple. She would be incapable of separating the act of sex from true love.
We've been over this before, Domi. I'm too old and you're too young and the twain will never meet.
She raised her left leg, smoothing the scarlet stocking.
Interesting color combination. Your black on my white. My white on your black. Think how nice.
I'm trying not to. Get your goddamn clothes on and go.
A sudden emotion flashed through her eyes like a streak of crimson lightning.
What?
She quickly twisted back over on her stomach.
Colors, that's it. You like snotty DeFore's color better.
Now that you mention it.
Domi sat up sharply, kneeling in the middle of the bed, her pert taut breasts pointed at him.
Knew it! Take that bitch outside and kick her fat ass off cliff!
Shit. I've had enough of this behavior for one day.
A quick lunge brought Grant to the bedside. He yanked up the edges of the top sheet and flung them over Domi's head. He grasped the excess cloth in both hands, trapping Domi inside the sheet like a small animal inside of a bag.
Let me out, goddammit!
Grant easily swung her off the bed and carried her over to the door.
Oh, damn it!
Go to bed.
But you get ready. I be back.
At 0755, in the anteroom connected to the jump chamber, the three of them inventoried their ordnance and other equipment. Kane and Grant wore their grin-laden combat harnesses over black high-necked sweaters. Both of them were shod in heavy-treaded, fleece-lined boots. They stuffed gloves and woolen scarves into the pockets of their ankle-length, black Kevlar weave coats. The mag-issue coats offered a degree of protection against penetration weapons, and they were insulated against all weathers, including acid rain showers. Transcom circuitry was sewn inside the lapels, terminating in tiny pin mics connected to a thin wire pulley. If they were searched, the transceivers would pass a cursory inspection. Long combat knives, the razor-keen blades forged of dark blue steel, hung from sheaths at their hips. They made sure the sin-eaters were secure in the holsters strapped to their forearms. The big-bore automatic hand blasters, less than 14 inches in length at full extension, had magazines carrying 20 9mm rounds. When not in use, the stock folded over the top of the blaster, reducing its holstered length to 10 inches. When the weapons were needed, they had only to tense their wrist tendons, and sensitive actuators would activate flexible cables within the holsters and snap the pistols smoothly into their waiting hands, the butts unfolding in the same motion. Since the Sin-Eaters had no trigger guards or safeties, the blasters fired immediately upon touching their crooked index fingers. Bridget wore a similar coat with voluminous pockets. Inside one pocket was a flat case containing emergency medical supplies, including hypodermics of pain suppressants, stimulants, and antibiotics. Snugged in another pocket was her sidearm of choice, a stub-barreled Mauser with an extended magazine holding 14 rounds of .32 caliber ammunition.
You really taking that Mauser?
Yes, what's the problem?
The problem is it only has an accuracy range of 25 meters. Not to mention the rate of fire is unreliable.
Well, this Mauser weighs considerably less than that H&K VP-70 I've been using, and the recoil's negligible. Works for me.
Bry came in from the control center. A small man with rounded shoulders and curly, copper-colored hair, he handed Bridget a folded map, a transcom unit, a rad counter, and a square metal and leather case containing survival rations, such as concentrated foodstuffs and bottles of purified water. Bridget hung the case over her shoulder by its straps.
You know we're unable to receive a read on the auto-sequence initiators on the Peridolinko unit, right?
We heard that.
Since we can't synchronize the Matterstream modulations, you three may suffer a bout of extreme jump sickness.
Kane tested his Nighthawk microlight, thumbing it on and off.
Why?
If the modulations are synchronized, you slide along the quantum path to your destination. But when they aren't synchronized, you more or less slam into your destination.
We've had jump sickness before. It's tolerable.
Yeah, well, This time it may be bad.
How bad?
No way of telling, sir. Could be nothing more severe than you've already experienced. Headaches and a temporary touch of nausea.
Or?
Or an incapacitating weakness that may last several hours. Or hallucinations, and overall, a debilitated physical condition.
Bridget patted the pocket containing the medical kit.
That's why we have this.
Uh-huh. One more thing?
One more? This just gets better and better.
You understand how the Matrans unit in this facility is the only one with no transit feed connection to the others? Its jump lines are untraceable.
Yeah.
That's a two-edged sword with a Paradolinko unit. We aren't sure if we can achieve a retrieval lock. So, if conditions warrant, remain close to the chamber and hit the LD button.
The LD button, last destination, was a fallback device designed to bring jumpers back to their point of origin if they materialized either in hostile environments or at the incorrect transit point.
And if they don't warrant?
Conduct your mission. When you return to the Paradolinko chamber, simply encode this unit's coordinates in the normal manner.
Simple, actually.
It's always been so, hasn't it?
Bridget didn't even look at him. Picking up a fur hat from the table, she turned toward the door leading to the Matrans chamber.
Gentlemen, the motherland awaits.
They went through the anteroom and entered the gateway chamber. As Kane closed the heavy armaglass door behind them, the lock mechanism triggered the automatic jump initiator. He glanced toward Bridget, but she refused to make eye contact, still giving him the silent treatment. He knew he had offended her the night before, but he doggedly told himself he didn't care. Baptiste was too clinical, too fixated on logic and reason to ever truly understand him. He sometimes wondered why he had sacrificed everything for a woman who treated him most of the time as though he were a mentally deficient jolt brain. Maybe one day he would find out, but he doubted it. The hexagonal metal discs above and below exuded a shimmering glow that slowly intensified. The fine mist gathered and climbed from the floor and wafted down from the ceiling. Tiny crackling static discharges flared in the vapor. The mist thickened, curling around to engulf them. Kane peeled back the cuff of his coat, looking at his wrist chron.
I just thought of something.
Kane felt as if a 10-ton meat cleaver crashed down on the crown of his head, splitting scalp and skull, wedging deeply between the hemispheres of his brain. Implode grins detonated behind each eye. His consciousness skidded and reeled over impossibly curved and deep abysses. It was a confusion of speed, distortion, a plunging, spinning whirlpool that was all inside the confines of his head, but immense enough to encompass the entire galaxy-flecked universe. Round and round, faster, lurching, rolling, caught helplessly in a torrent of energy that somehow was not energy, a raging flame that didn't burn, but chilled with a cold deeper than a gale whipping from the lifeless vacuum of space. There were colors he had never seen before, never known existed, sounds that he couldn't hear, but caused him soul-deep agony. He felt as though his mind were the size of a quivering atom, driven through a mad, roaring, icy void. Then he saw himself, and he saw Baptiste and Grant, and though they didn't look like themselves, he recognized them, knew them. Kane glimpsed himself crouching in a primordial jungle, clad in animal skins, and frightened. His father was Grant, his uncle was Baptiste, and his brother was Salvo. He saw himself, Baptiste, and Grant, their faces painted blue, fighting the armored legions of Rome, reeling back, gashed and defeated. He saw a walled city exploding with flame, and he stood back to back with Grant, exchanging sword strokes with a massed horde of red-handed butchers who owed allegiance to Attila. He saw Baptiste, a beautiful captive, dragged the stirrup of a Norman lord's horse, and he tried to cut her free, only to be cut down himself by the bone-shattering fall of a spiked mace. He saw himself struggling against the hands that forced his head down cruelly on a blood-stained headman's block in Kilmenham Jail, and the smirking man who had betrayed him to the British was Salvo. He saw himself dressed in fringed buckskins, standing on a narrow parapet, sighting down a long Kentucky rifle. He was praying for one clear shot at Generalissimo Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna. The elaborately uniformed caudillo had aquiline, aristocratic features, but his cold, dark eyes were the eyes of Salvo. Though Kane couldn't see them, he knew Bridget and Grant were somewhere within the crumbling adobe walls of the old mission on the Bejar River. He saw himself astride a pony, galloping, wild and fierce, feathers in his long, streaming hair, as he rode down on the blue-clad Wasikan soldiers at Greasy Grass. The white soldier chief was wide-eyed with terror, and though Kane's people called him Pahaska, he knew he was really Salvo. The chaotic montage of images seemed to slow, and a sleet storm of emotion swept over him. Kane knew the agonies of defeat and the pain of wounds and the bitterness of love and trust betrayed. Through it all, he recognized Grant and Baptiste and all the bodies that had carried their souls throughout the changing ages, throughout the long track of savagery, valor, loyalty, and deceit. And always, in the bloody scenes of the strife, their spirits were together, living and battling and dying, being reborn, and somehow always finding one another again. And now they had found each other again, perhaps for the final time. With a convulsive effort, Kane opened his eyes, and the motion felt as if it blew the top of his head off. He felt as if he were painfully clawing his way out of some deep chasm. He strained every particle of his battered consciousness to understand, to see. The last tendrils of mist were clearing away, and he could feel the tingling static discharges from the raised metallic discs beneath his body. He lay on his back, and he couldn't move. It was as if something had sucked the strength out of him. His mind rolled with confused questions. Through the blurred swirl of his vision, he tried to see the color of the armaglass. Wiping his running nose on the sleeve of his coat, Kane painfully hitched himself up on an elbow, squinting through the dim light. He saw Bridget curled in a fetal position on the far side of the six-sided chamber. Her mouth sagged partly open. Her eyes were closed, and tears glistened on her cheeks. Her shoulders quivered.
Oh. God damn.
Kane pushed himself up in a half-prone position, putting his back against the earth-toned armaglass wall, silently enduring an attack of vertigo. He massaged his throbbing temples with trembling hands. It felt as if the walls of his cranium had been scoured with fistfuls of sand. His stomach lurched and boiled and twisted in cramps.
So, this is what slamming instead of sliding feels like.
Grant squirmed his way to a sitting position, resting his forehead against his knees.
My head feels like a slag hole full of sticky piss.
Did you dream?
I did something. Probably in my pants. Oh, God. Please don't let me puke. If I start, I probably won't stop.
Kane looked over toward Bridget. She was still curled up on the floor.
Baptiste.
She didn't respond. He forced himself to his hands and knees, surprised and irritated by how weak he was. As he crawled over to her, he realized the chamber was slightly smaller than the one in Cerberus, around three-quarters the size. He knelt beside her and gently shook her by the shoulder.
Baptiste?
She didn't respond, so he slapped her cheek. Blinking, she stared up at Kane in complete disorientation, her emerald eyes clouded by confusion and tears. Her hand shot up and closed around his wrist with a fierce strength, her nails biting into his flesh. She lunged into a sitting position, clutching him in a desperate embrace.
I saw you die, Kane. I saw you die. You were trying to save me.
Kane was too stunned to speak. He had already discounted his vision during the transit as a dream, a nightmare, just another symptom of jump sickness. He didn't want to speculate that it might have been anything else. He refused to speculate that it might be anything else.
Just a dream, Baptiste. A hallucination. Like Bry warned us about.
Some of the tension went out of Bridget's body, and she pushed herself away from Kane, her eyes scanning his face quickly, intently, as though she were convincing herself that he truly was who he was supposed to be. Inside him, Kane felt a jolt as he saw the longing in her eyes, knew it to be a reflection of the longing in his own soul. Then the moment was gone. She turned away quickly, wiping at the tears on her cheeks.
A hallucination. I'm all right now.
She tried to stand up, staggered and swayed, and would have fallen had Kane not reached up and steadied her.
Take it slow. We're all in rocky shape.
My head is splitting. Anyone else need a pain reliever?
I'm feeling a little better. Let's give ourselves a few minutes to recover before we juice ourselves up.
The three of them remained where they were for a while, and at length the pain in Kane's head abated, though his stomach was still tied in cramped knots. Carefully, as if he were 90 years old, he climbed to his feet and stumbled on rubbery legs to the heavy door of the chamber. He noticed immediately that the handle was bent in the middle. Obviously, some terrific force had been exerted upon it. He looked over his shoulder at Grant.
How are you feeling?
The big man placed his hands flat on the metal discs, pushing himself up out of his sitting position.
Like 220-odd pounds of steam shit.
He reeled dizzily for a second, running a hand over his face. He dabbed at blood on his upper lip that had trickled from a nostril.
Anybody else bleeding?
Only you, as far as I know.
Remember that shot of infrasound you took in Dalsa? It ruptured and weakened the subcutaneous capillaries in your nose. Whenever you experience a sudden pressure change, there will be some minor hemorrhaging.
Figures. Are we ready to face the motherland?
Ready as we'll ever be.
Bridget moved away from the door, her hand reaching inside her coat pocket for the Mauser. Kane and Grant exchanged curt nods, tensed their wrist tendons, and the sin-eaters slapped into their waiting palms. Grasping the door handle, Kane lifted and turned it. Noting the unusual sound of the lock, Kane towed the door open slowly, a few inches at a time. There was no adjacent recovery anteroom beyond. The jump chamber opened directly into a small control room, barely 20 feet across. Kane saw a single, simplified master control console running the length of one wall, and he recognized a few of the basic command panels from Cerberus. Many of the indicator lights were dark, and the walls showed black soot streaks from a long-ago fire. One section of the metal and plastic console was warped out of shape, sagging slightly toward the floor. He stepped into the room, surveying it with quick, alert glances. The light source was a dim, triple neon strip on the ceiling. Only intermittent pieces of it glowed. Most of it was melted, dangling down like congealed noodles. In the corners, he looked for functioning vid spy eyes. He saw one mounted on the north wall, but a close examination showed him it was inoperable.
Looks clean.
Grant moved out, blaster at the ready. Bridget followed him, sweeping the short barrel of the Mauser back and forth.
Small. Not like the redoubt specs Lockesh showed me.
This isn't a redoubt. It's a Dutch.
Dacha.
Uh-huh.
Fire damage to some of the sensor outfeed circuits on the master console. No wonder we couldn't get a read on the auto-sequence initiators. It's a minor miracle there was an open transit link at all.
Let's save the hosannas until we find out for sure where we are. For all we know, we were routed to one of the alternate units Lockesh mentioned.
Kane walked swiftly to the double set of sectors. They were painted a very pale shade of green, though patches of it were scorched and pitted. The green control lever in the frame was in the down or closed position. He put his ear to the door, knowing that most sounds couldn't penetrate the thick, sound-absorbing vanadium alloy. Kane assumed a combat stance in front of the doors while Grant moved into position at the control lever. Kane nodded, and Grant threw up the lever, jamming it hard into its brackets. Kane tensed, finger crooked around the firing stud of his blaster. He didn't really know what to expect, but he was surprised by the sight revealed by the opening doors. He looked into a short, earthen tunnel. Its floor was tightly packed dirt. The walls and low ceiling were supported by an arrangement of square wooden timbers. The feeble light from the control room penetrated only a few feet into the tunnel. So Kane fished his microlight from his pocket and turned it on. Grant peered around the doorframe, taking his night vision glasses from his coat and slipping them on his face. The specially treated lenses of the mag-issue glasses allowed him to see clearly in deep shadow for approximately 10 feet, as long as there was some kind of light source. The narrow amber beam of the tiny flashlight illuminated a plastic box switch on the wall near the right door. He flicked the switch, and a few naked bulbs on the ceiling glowed to grudging life. A barred gate blocked the end of the passageway. Kane strode into the cramped tunnel, tasting the very cool, sour air. With the boar of the sin-eater leading the way, he walked to the barrier in the far wall. The bars were made of high-grade vanadium steel, as thick as his index finger. The crossbars were 3 inches apart. The top, the sides, and the bottom of the gate were set flush in a concrete frame. The barrier was secured by a keypad quad-electronic lock, and he could tell that not even one of his grens would breach it. The lock didn't look like part of the original door, as if it had been installed later as an additional security measure.
Can it be opened?
Not by force. I hope a sign is among the odds and ends you thought to bring along, Baptiste.
Bridget dipped her hand into a pocket of her coat and produced a small metal device shaped like an elongated circle. The Nemo sign was an electronic lock decryptor. Bridget placed the sign against the keypad, thumbed a stud on its surface, and initialized the decryption mechanism. The tight-band high-power microwave frequency overrode the lock's microprocessors. Gingerly, Kane pushed with the barrel of his blaster, and the barred door swung silently open.
Handy little gizmo.
Me or the sign?
Both. So far.
As the gate swung open, an overhead neon strip fluttered and came on. The three of them walked through the door and into a small, concrete-walled chamber, like a 10-foot-square cube. The floor was still dirt, but slightly moist. A rusted metal cabinet was affixed to the wall by screws. It gaped open, showing only empty, warped shelves. Just on the other side of the locker was a heavy wooden door. It bore an ordinary knob made of aluminum. Kane gripped it and twisted it cautiously. By the light of his nighthawk, he saw the foot of a black, wrought-iron spiral staircase corkscrewing up into darkness. The steps and handrails were flecked and flaking with rust. The air was considerably colder now, and not quite as stale. Grant craned his neck, peering upward. His breath plumed out before him.
That's a long climb.
Kane placed his miniature flashlight between his teeth and tugged on a pair of black leather gloves. Bridget did the same and donned her fur cap. Kane attached the microlight to his left index finger by its tiny Velcro strap, wearing it like a ring.
I'd hate to make that climb and find out we're not in Russia after all.
Kane scaled the first few treads of the stairs, testing them.
It feels cold enough to be Russia. These steps seem solid enough.
They began climbing, Kane taking the point as always. It was an ingrained habit from his years in the Mag Division. When he acted as point man, he felt electrically alive, sharply attuned to every nuance of his surroundings. After a few turns of the staircase, no light from below penetrated. In fact, it was just a tiny pinpoint of pale yellow far below. He paused long enough to put on his dark vision glasses. Though the Nighthawk microlight emitted a powerful beam, the illumination it cast didn't pierce the shadows more than 10 feet above him. The longer they climbed, the higher they went, the colder it became. Kane estimated they had climbed for some 10 minutes before he reached the final curve of the spidery iron spiral. He stepped out onto a wide metal platform about a dozen feet square.
End of the trail.
What's up there?
Kane shone his light around. The needle beam touched a blank metal wall, haloing a wedge-shaped handle and a pair of deadlock bolts. Both of them were pushed to one side.
A door. Unlocked.
Grant and Bridget joined Kane on the landing.
This shaft is deep. We must have climbed 200 feet.
Hell of a construction project, burying the gateway that far beneath the Duchess.
Dacha.
Get ready.
Kane stepped to the door, grasped the handle, and turned it.
Come on. Open.
Taking and holding a deep breath, Kane put all of his upper body strength into the turn, pushing at the same time with a shoulder. The door popped open, and a shockingly frigid rush of air swept over him. Off balance, he stumbled forward through the doorway.
Holy shit!
He froze, flinging out a hand to anchor himself to some iron gridwork. He was standing inside of an enclosed box made of bolted-together sections of rusty grillwork. He felt trapped, as though he were in a cage. It was barely large enough to accommodate him. He waited for the tight fist of fear to relax its grip on his reflexes. His rigid training subsumed the surprise and fright swarming through his mind. Eyes stinging from the icy lash of the wind, Kane surveyed his position, and he disliked it immensely. He was at least 75 feet above the overgrown ground. It was patched whitely with small areas of fresh snow. Looking between the intersecting metal slats, he saw a few rocks, a lot of weeds, and very little else. A night bright with stars and a cloud-covered moon shone overhead. By its uncertain light, he saw a fenced perimeter encircling the area for 100 yards all around. The fence line ran along the crest of a small ridge, and though he couldn't be sure, it looked as if lengths of razor and barbed wire were stretched between the 10-foot-tall posts. Glancing over his shoulder, he saw the door he had forced open had been disguised to look like an oversized chimney flue. In fact, the entire shaft was made of red, mortared brick, just like a chimney.
This makes no damn sense at all.
Grant poked his head out of the doorway.
What doesn't? Holy shit, what is this?
That's what I want to know. Let Baptiste out here. Maybe she'll have a notion.
Grant withdrew back into the shaft and allowed Bridget to step out into the grill-enclosed box. She didn't appear overly surprised.
Lakesh said there was a house here. A mansion, judging by the size of the chimney. I'll bet we're standing where the attic used to be. See, if you look out there really closely, you can just make out the outline of a structure on the ground.
What happened to it?
Destroyed. Burned down. Who knows? Obviously, somebody must have known the chimney led to the Mattrans unit and took pains to secure it. Demolishing the house would have been the first step.
There isn't a way out.
There has to be. Look at the chimney beneath you.
By peering between the slats, Kane saw a series of U-shaped iron rungs set into the exterior of the chimney, leading down to the ground. They were dark and discolored by time and exposure.
And I thought your eyes were bad, Baptiste.
He dropped to his knees, exploring the grill with his fingers. Grant poked his head out.
What's going on?
Kane didn't respond for a moment. Inserting his hand between the flat iron strips, he touched an object.
Found a lock. Feels like, yeah, a combination lock attached to the underside.
He put his face close to the slats.
Not enough room to work our hands down there, even if we wanted to try to figure out the combination. We'll have to shoot it off.
Kane tried jamming the barrel of the Sin Eater between the narrow spaces, but the diameter of the bore was too big.
Let me try.
Obligingly, Kane stood and moved to the far side of the cage. She knelt down, Mauser in her hand. The slender barrel slid in easily between the slats.
Done. And with less noise than that cannon of yours.
She rejoined Grant back on the chimney platform while Kane struggled to raise the floor grill. Hooking his fingers around a pair of cross pieces, he heaved, wrestled, and finally managed to lift the section up on hidden hinges.
If I knew you were going to make that much noise, I would have suggested you use your grenades.
Kane swung his body through the opening, his feet groping for and finding the first rung. He pushed his blaster back into the forearm holster and went down, hand over hand. He estimated the temperature was probably in the high teens, but the wind chill factor dropped it to the single digits. The ladder rungs were sunk deeply into the brickwork, and unlike the spiral staircase, seemed rock solid under his weight. He guessed the ladder was of more recent workmanship. He alighted at the base of the chimney in waist-high weeds. Kicking at the turf, he uncovered a chunk of charred wood, fire hardened to the consistency of stone. The digging toe of his boot revealed a streak of stained white in the dirt. By the time the other two joined him, he had pulled a big square of white plastic out of the half-frozen ground. Several words were imprinted on it, and though Kane couldn't decipher them, he recognized exclamation points and the meaning of the red skull symbol.
That settles the question of whether we're in Russia or not.
What's it say?
Foreboding. No, forbidden zone. Trespassers will be put to death without trial. By order of internal security, signed Major Commissar Zimyanin.
You think this Major Commissar burned down the house to camouflage the gateway?
Possibly. Look at this series of numbers at the bottom of the skull insignia. That's the date of the notice. 90-some years ago.
Kane dropped the square placard and consulted his wrist chron.
927. Why is it so dark?
Different latitude and longitude. We're about 10 hours later than in Cerberus.
That's what I was wondering. I was getting ready to ask about the time difference right as we jumped.
Dawn is a long time away. What do we do until then?
Bridget drew the map from her pocket. Unfolding it, she traced a wavery line with a gloved forefinger.
We're here. Paradolinko itself was a medium-sized vill before the nuke cost, and if it survived, it's only a mile or so away. It's on the route we'll have to take to Moscow, so maybe we can find some transportation there that will at least get us to the inner suburbs.
Kane looked toward the fence. Some of the support posts had fallen down, leaving gaps wide enough to walk through. Beyond the fence, on the other side of the ridge, a tree line masked blackly against the sky.
It looks like a damn wilderness out there to me. Maybe we should wait until daybreak. Even if there's a path in there, we'll have a hell of a time finding it.
I'd rather find out now.
Me too. We can always come back and make camp.
Oh, democracy sucks. Let's do it then.
Bridget quickly checked her rad counter. The reading hovered at mid-range green.
Safe enough?
A gibbous moon, between half and full, moved in and out of heavy clouds as they walked across the weed-choked ground and up the slight slope to the fence line. Most of the strands of barbed wire were completely encrusted with rust and broke easily when they applied pressure. The three of them stepped through a wide-open space between a pair of fallen posts. Outside of the perimeter, they found another plastic sign promising death to interlopers. They moved quickly and quietly toward the trees, Kane a few yards ahead, pausing now and then to test the air for sounds or scents. He heard nothing unusual and smelled only damp vegetable matter. A very brief snow flurry whitened and wetted their hair and clothing. Right at the edge of the tree line, in a shallow coulee, they found a path. It was a cramped draw, meandering in and then out of the border of the woods. Though it was narrow, Kane saw the faint tread marks made by a wheeled vehicle. There were also the impressions of shod horse hooves.
These tracks weren't made recently. Days, maybe even weeks ago.
It's a sign of some kind of habitation, at least.
They began walking again, the trees offering something in the way of a windbreak. Grant continued to check their back trail, a part of magistrate training that was now an ingrained, unconscious habit. The towering chimney was out of sight, concealed by the dip in the terrain and the woods. Within half a mile, they reached a cracked and furrowed blacktop road. The asphalt had a peculiar ripple pattern to it, and weeds sprouted from splits in the surface. Kane and Grant had seen the rippling effect before, out in the Hell Zones. It was a characteristic result of earthquakes triggered by nuclear bomb shockwaves. On the other side of the road was a grove of larches. They moved into the damp gloom between the tree trunks, avoiding spaces where the undergrowth was tangled and thick with thorns. They passed through a tiny, shallow creek that was edged with a thin layer of ice. Suddenly, Kane came to a halt, hands signaling behind him for silence, though Grant and Bridget had been too preoccupied with their cold feet to be talking.
Listen. Hear it? Like hammering.
I don't hear anything.
They huddled in silence, but heard nothing except the wind. Kane moved forward again, the other two allowing him the point once more. After marching another few minutes, they noticed that the larches no longer grew so closely together. They passed sawn and chopped away stumps. Kane stopped again and went to one knee, gazing intently ahead. Bridget and Grant followed suit on either side of him. In a clearing, several wooden houses were scattered, some with thatched roofs. All were small and ramshackle. None of them showed lights. Windows and doors were boarded up or open and dark. In the center of the clump of houses, rearing from a bare patch of dirt, was a stone-walled well. Kane, Grant, and Bridget crouched at the edge of the clearing, watching and listening. There were only shadows moving among the ruined structures, caused by moonlight filtering through breaks in the scudding clouds. Kane eased out into the clearing, walking heel and toe in the characteristic way of a mag penetrating a potential kill zone. Grant and Bridget followed him in single file, giving him a 12-yard lead. Kane approached the nearest house at an oblique angle and looked in through the open door. A gust of wind set it to banging, and he realized that was the hammering sound he'd heard. He shone his microlight into the place, seeing nothing but empty, dusty dark, stripped of all signs that it had ever been inhabited. Circling the house, he noticed the barren remains of a fair-sized vegetable garden in the rear. The furrows were overgrown with weeds. Two more houses were similarly deserted, and both of them had cultivated ground in the back. Some distance away, he saw a big, rambling barn, most of it intact. He strode toward it, gesturing for Bridget and Grant to pick up the pace. The doors were missing, and Kane speculated that looters had removed them and the hinges and carted them off. At the cavernous opening, he paused, waiting for his companions. The amber light from his flashlight illuminated dimly only part of the blackness within the barn. Bridget came to his side, adding the glow from her own microlight to his.
What are we doing here?
The place looks like it had been a thriving vill. Where did the people and the animals go, and why?
For all you know, this place has been deserted since Skydark.
No way. This place has been deserted for a long time, but not that long.
Maybe when Major Commissar Semyonian secured the dacha, he moved all the people out of here, afraid they'd be Mat-Trans jumping to hell and gone.
Doubtful. That was nearly a century ago. This place was abandoned only in the last couple of years, five at the outside.
So what? Not everything you stumble over is a mystery you have to solve, you know.
First of all, judging by the tracks we found, somebody hangs around here. And they own a wag, or a horse-drawn wag. Second, this barn is the most likely place in the area to keep them. And lastly, if nothing else, We can spend the night here out of that bastard cold wind and even light a fire without it being spotted.
Oh.
Kane stepped over the earthen threshold. He immediately smelled mustiness and the cloying stench of something dead, something a long time dead. The interior of the barn seemed saturated by the charnel house reek. Queasiness reawakened in his stomach and his mouth filled with sour saliva. He stopped in mid-stride, fanning his microlight around. The needle of light touched gray shapes dangling from the rafters by lengths of hemp. The shapes were wired together animal skeletons, and he had trouble identifying them. It took him a second to realize that horse skulls had been attached to dog vertebrae, and the jawbones of cows were affixed to the fleshless horned heads of goats.
Holy shit, look at this.
A big low table, crudely fashioned, occupied the center of the barn. It was one of the doors, supported on four corners by the bleached thigh bones of either cattle or horses. Kane moved deeper into the darkness, the beam of his flashlight striking dull reflections from metal. A large brass bowl served as the centerpiece for the makeshift table. It was round and very deep, discolored by verdigris. At the edge of the makeshift table, Kane leaned forward, directing his penlight into the bowl. Old, dark stains thickly coated its curving inner walls. Piled neatly inside of it were small, delicate bones. Resting atop them, an equally small and delicate skull grinned up at the shadows overhead. Kane felt his heart pound wildly as he stared, transfixed at the skeletonized remains of a human infant who could have been no more than 6 months old. He wasn't aware of Bridget coming to his side.
Oh, my God.
What the fuck was that?
The sound came from somewhere deep in the gloom, too deep for a small light to pierce. The foul miasma Kane had scented upon entering the barn seemed to fill his nostrils.
There!
Two eyes the color of old ice gleamed out of the shadows on the far side of the table. Even in their lights, none of them could quickly categorize, identify, or otherwise recognize the shape advancing out of the murk. It was no use to call it any other name than a thing. It stood, swaying slightly on the opposite side of the long, low table, regarding them quietly. The sin eater filled Kane's hand, and its comforting weight helped to make his eyes and reasoning centers work in tandem again. His unblinking stare took in the tall, cold-eyed form. The face was heavily rouged, thickly caked with an orange powder. Bright red, pendulous lips were quirked in a toothless rictus that may have been a smile. The black outlines of its eyelids revealed a successful experiment with a burned match. The sweeping eyelashes were so long, so fluttery, they were obviously artificial. The eyes were a pale, nearly colorless gray. The whites showed all around the iris and lent a hypnotic intensity to the hard, thoughtful stare. Framing the pear-shaped baby face was a fall of long tresses of different colors and textures, as if several heads of human hair were woven together to make a grotesque wig. The creature's garb was a mismatched collection of rags and tatters, some of them moldering and rotten with age. Jutting out between the folds of cloth was a long, thick, pink cylinder. After staring at it for a shocked second, Kane realized the enormous erection was fashioned from wax. The thing waved a hand sporting very long, very curved black fingernails.
Dobrynye vechye, tovarishes.
Spasiba.
What did it say?
Good evening, friends. I said thanks.
Angelis?
Niet.
Amerikis.
Da.
The thing flung one taloned hand in front of its rouged lips. Both Kane and Grant found the hyper-feminine gesture thoroughly repulsive.
What the fuck is it, man or woman?
Budut vami. Pochemu vie odet nie kakto. Who are you? Why are you dressed like that?
The creature lifted the frayed hem of its robe and twirled in a clumsy, coquettish pirouette.
I just might puke twice today.
Moje imenje Budev Kasilov. Ja budu skatsi. Ja budu jedestvenje. Fjaschenik kom nalevo nalevo.
At one point, the creature caressed the wax phallus in an openly lascivious manner.
Okay. Try to keep your stomachs in one place. It's a man. Sort of. Used to be.
What?
His name is Koshalov. He's a Skopsi.
I thought he was a Russian.
He is. The Skopsis were a religious sect which flourished in Russia 400 years ago. The cult traces its origins back to the pagan goddess Cybele, whose priests wore women's clothes and castrated themselves as sacrificial offerings at her altars. Apparently, after the cleansing, the cult enjoyed a brief revival. He claims he is the only priest left.
Probably chill the villagers and their animals and whatever insane rites they've got. Let's blast the crazy son of a bitch and move on.
Wait!
Bridget waved her hand at the dangling skeletons, then to the bowl containing the bones of the child.
Gde selchanin? Chei kostochski etimi? Vie ubili ich? Where are the villagers? Whose bones are these? Did you murder them?
Koshalov's eyes blinked, and he shook his head so vigorously that his makeshift wig nearly slipped from his bald pate.
Yet. Perdelinko was a Skopsi vale for many, many years. We live in peace here. Then a new regime took power in Moscow and classified everyone here as undesirables, as perverts, as spies. We suffered through a long reign of terror. The villagers, who were not murdered, fled the place. As the high priest, I stayed behind, lest I violate my oath to Cybele. The bones are those of my own animals, and the child's skeleton is my son's. All were killed by the police. I dug them up.
Bridget translated for Kanan Grant.
I don't know whether to believe him or not.
Why'd he mix and match those wired together skeletons overhead, then?
For one, he's obviously insane. For another, he switched the remains according to gender. Female skulls on male bodies or vice versa, in accordance to Cybele's necromantic rites.
So he's not a murderer, just a fused-out ghoul. That makes me feel a whole lot better.
I have been praying to Cybele to send me new acolytes, and my prayers have at last been answered!
Koshalov inclined his head, putting his hands together, the tips of the long, ragged nails touching. Bridget translated.
I don't think so.
If the dumb bastard castrated himself, how could he have a son?
Good point. I'll ask him.
Bridget spoke to Koshalov. The man acted as though he hadn't heard. Head still bowed, he turned and shuffled into the gloom.
Koshalov!
Koshalov continued shuffling, out of the range of the two microlights.
Hold it, Chief!
With shocking suddenness, the shadows around, behind, and above them erupted with a flurry of movement. The pungent odor of rot grew perceptibly stronger, like a wave. Something brushed the crown of Kane's head. He ducked instinctively, his hand rising to shine his light overhead. A loop of thin, flexible wire encircled his wrist. The wire tightened, and a jerk from above snatched his arm up, shooting a streak of pain into his shoulder socket.
Shit!
Kane turned on his toes, wrenching at the wire. In the dim, wavering light, he saw Grant, his arms flying up to horizontal positions, pointing in two directions. His wrists were snared by loops of wire, and they were pulled simultaneously by two ragged figures on either side of the barn. Bridget clutched at her throat with both hands, her teeth bared. Her hat fell off, and Kane glimpsed a glinting strand of wire stretching up from the base of her neck into the shadow-shrouded rafters. He pressed the trigger of the Sin Eater, and bursts of orange flame smeared the darkness. Pieces of bullet-chopped wood showered down, and a dangling skeleton danced and flew to flinders under the barrage. The tension on the wire around Bridget's throat relaxed. She dropped to her knees, followed half a heartbeat later by a ragged, robed body plummeting down from above. A flailing leg struck her a glancing blow on the shoulder on the way down, knocking her onto her side. Another wire loop shot out of the darkness and wrapped itself around Kane's right forearm. His gun hand was wrenched painfully across his torso, the Sin Eater pressing against his ribs. For a fraction of a second, he considered the ludicrous picture he presented, standing on his toes, one arm straight up, the other wrapped around his torso, as though he were frozen while performing some bizarre semaphore dance.
Politica ich!
A half dozen more, wigged and rouged figures flounced out of the murk from all sides, rags and tatters flying. They carried long wooden poles, once the handles of hoes and rakes, with loops of knotted baling wire attached to the ends. Kane struggled, kicking at the nearest figure. His boot connected solidly with a knee. If they were all Skopsis, there was little point in aiming for the groin. The man went down, plucking at his leg. His wig fell off and lay on the floor like the carcass of a small, shaggy animal. In a helpless rage, Grant watched as a Skopsi dealt Kane a fierce blow with the butt of the wooden handle.
Oh, damn!
The wire snugged around his right wrist and fouled in the mechanism of his forearm holster and prevented the Sin Eater from sliding into his hand. He saw Bridget, half prone on the ground, snap desperately at the stinking air and try to pull open the noose around her throat. Grant struggled, yanking both arms upward. He received sharp, painful tugs as a response. Muscles bulging beneath his coat, Grant strained to drag his left arm toward him. The pulling pressure increased, and if not for the glove, the flesh around his wrist would have been lacerated. He maintained the tension for a few seconds, then relaxed his arm. The Scotsy, holding the pole on his left, stumbled back, pulling Grant with him. With all the speed and strength his training had bred into him, he leaped toward the ragged man. The surging strength of that unexpected lunge pulled the man on his right off his feet. The pole slid through his hands, inflicting painful friction burns on both palms.
Give me that, asshole.
Grant snatched the end of the wooden handle from the hands of the Scotsy on his left. He thrust it forward like a spear with all his strength and weight. The blunt end of the stave caught the man directly on the bridge of his nose, right between his black-lined eyes. He twitched in a spasm and toppled backward, slamming against the barn wall, his wig falling forward over his face. Spinning on his heels, Grant yanked the pole from the dead man's clenching and unclenching hands. As he spun, he swung the wooden handle in a short arc. The arc ended against the Scopsy hanging on to his right wrist. The blunt end smashed into a rouge-reddened cheek, cracking the bone. The robed man cartwheeled and thudded down on the packed dirt of the barn floor with an impact that drove all signs of life from his eyes. Encumbered by the pole still attached to his left wrist, Grant tried to free the Sin Eater from the coil of wire around his forearm. An avalanche of forms struck him from all directions. Clutching hands gripped his arms, his neck. Long nails clawed for his eyes, raking away his dark vision glasses. Bridget managed to insert her fingers into the strangling noose around her throat and work some slack into it. Even as she did so, a knot of Scopsies flung themselves out of the gloom, bearing down on her. As the first figure reached for her, she performed a backward somersault, intending to come out of the roll on her feet. Her long, heavy coat skewed her timing, misplaced her center of balance, and when she rolled erect, she lost her footing.
Ah!
She stumbled backward, and only the barn wall prevented her from falling. For a split, frozen second, she surveyed the scene in the barn. Grant was struggling with three Scotsies, who were trying to force him down on the ground. Kane was snared in a tough wire web, and three more of the ragtag cultists charged her. She didn't waste time trying to draw her Mauser. One of the three Scopsies lowered his long-tressed head and rammed it into her lower belly, carrying her up and backward with the intention of pinning her against the wall. She cupped her hands and slapped them swiftly and sharply against the sides of his head over his hair-screened ears. The Scopsy let her go and fell to his hands and knees. Bridget tried to twist away from his two companions. One of them kicked out and her legs went out from under her. She sprawled half across the table, the vibrations of her falling body sending the bone-filled bowls skittering toward the edge. The two cultists were in such a hurry to lay hands on her that they jostled into each other. One was shouldered aside, and the other reached out and gripped her left ankle. He dragged her toward him. Bridget raised her right leg and rammed the heel of her boot into the painted face. The Scopsy fell, blood gushing from split lips. His jaw hung askew. The third tattered scarecrow hurled himself over the fallen bodies of his comrades, hands wide, fingernails curved to rake the flesh from her face. It was Kushalov himself. Bridget planted both feet on his sternum, and using the momentum of his wild rush, her lithe legs levered up and flipped him over her. He rolled across the splintery surface of the table, and the bowl fell to the floor, scattering the small bones. Kushalov rolled from the table and dragged himself to his feet. His wax phallus was broken in half. He settled his wig firmly on his head and opened his mouth to speak. Kane, still hanging like a puppet, suddenly sagged against the grip of the wire around his left wrist. He drew his legs up, clear of the floor, bending them at the knee. Kushalov whirled at the sudden movement just as Kane pistoned out his legs. The thick treads of his boots smashed full into Koshalov's face. Kushalov's body rocketed backward. Even as he flailed away into the dimness, the unexpected drag on the wire around Kane's wrist overbalanced the man on the other end of it, crouching in the rafters. He fell headlong, hitting the hard-packed dirt with his face. Kane sat down hard on the ground. The man tried to push himself up. Almost casually, Kane kicked him in the side of the head, rolling him over into the gloom. He made no movement afterward. Simultaneously, Grant used the butt of the snare pole around his right arm as a bludgeon, whacking one of his assailants across the torso, sending him staggering toward the open door of the barn. With a sinuous twist of his body, he tore free of the two cultists. They clawed wildly for him. Brent broke the length of wood over a bewigged head, and as the man sagged to the floor, he thrust the sharp, splintered remainder into the third Scopsy's belly, then jerked it free. The man went to his knees, screaming, hands clapped over the crimson gushing from punctured flesh and stomach muscles. Bridget drew her Mauser and fired off a three-round burst into the gloom. Not knowing if the bullets hit anyone, but hoping the noise of the shots would unnerve the Scopsies enough so they would consider cutting their losses and scattering. The tendon-stretching pull on Kane's right wrist immediately slackened, and he jerked his almost numb arm backward, dragging a clattering pole from the shadows. He came to his feet in an angry rush, squeezing the trigger of his blaster. One of the cultists jumped at the shots. He lifted the hem of his robe and began a slap-footed run toward the barn entrance. Grant took a few steps in pursuit, thought better of it, and stopped to disentangle the wire noose from his wrist and the cable spring mechanism of the holster. The sin-eater slid into his palm, and it required a great effort to resist the savage temptation to empty the entire magazine in a 360-degree firing pattern. Kane clawed the wire loops from his wrists, glaring around, making an automatic body count. Out of the 10 ragged figures sprawled all over the barn, 4 would never rise again, Koshalov among them. Grant planted the bore of his blaster against the head of the man who tried to staunch the flow of blood from his ripped belly.
You fucking slagger. Here's your termination warrant.
No! We're the intruders here!
He assaulted a magistrate. They called down the thunder and now they'll earn and learn what it means.
You're not a magistrate anymore! If you were still a magistrate, you'd have to chill me, chill Domi, chill everybody in Cerberus. You're not a magistrate!
Grant's lips twitched in reaction to her words. By degrees, the maddened flame in his dark eyes guttered out. With a wordless snarl of disgust, he wheeled away from the Scopsy. Kane had watched and listened to the exchange with a cold, ironic smile on his face. He knew exactly how Grant felt, because his own ingrained mag pride was offended, and only blood and lives could redress the insult.
Is everybody all right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Good. And in case anyone was wondering, I've changed my mind about spending the night.